Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. A lawyer once said my program disclaimer that what I say on the air is perhaps my opinion only in all the cosmos was not legally acceptable because it did not conform to legal jargon. I disagreed because I figured it covered everything in creation since the Big Bang. He looked at me in a funny way and reluctantly conceded. So there you have it, which holds for today's program. First, I will start with Summer Gold Rush, which I wrote, and perhaps in one version or another, some of you have heard before. The silly season is in full avarice. Cash registers from coast to coast and amusement parks in between are playing America's song. Our Oregon and Washington beach towns are emporiums of prosperity, their streets and sands swarming with an annual infestation of sun and fun hungry protoplasm. Everybody wants a cut of the tourist buck. Tourism attempts to fill the void left by depleted natural resources whose exploitation built and sustained the local coastal culture until the forests were cut down and the great fish runs decimated by the impetuous greed of white settlers and their descendants. A magnificent land that had thrived for millennia was ravaged in a century. Sultans of fun replace loggers and fisher people. Shopping malls, motels, restaurants, and boutique bars restructure the Oregon coast. Cannon Beach, which in an earlier era resisted opportunities to be a second Carmel, has acquiesced and booms like a gold strike town. Seaside mixed its sand with water and remade its graceful downtown into a cement mall and its beachfront into huge cubes of high-rise motels. Astoria hustles its colorful history and Carpenter Gothic houses that built its hills to draw tourists from the beach towns, and in a very sense, draws affluent residents who avoid the more gaudy tourist traps. Complaints about tourism are usually whines about discourtesies, inconveniences, and crowds of noisy, fussy, impatient strangers. But sometimes criticisms are registered about the sort of environment that is being imposed upon a previously neglected string of coastal towns and the ambivalence of residents between tourist revenues and environmental quality. The current practices of coastal entrepreneurs are a local symptom of a national malady, that money is all that counts, and anything in the way of making a buck deserves to be deep-sixed, which, of course, includes residents unable to abide or afford the shifting economics. Tourism has an insidious habit of devouring what it seeks and distorts any authenticity it purports to represent. Amidst the commercial glitter and singing cash registers, the real gold is rapidly slipping out of our hands. Connie Rose Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach and in 1980 wrote an article for the North Coast Times Eagle, A Short History of Seaside, perceived clearly the changes tourism has wrought. Somewhere behind the pavement, the aluminum-framed, junk-filled windows, the pinball machines, and snow cone litter lurks the ghost of a pretty little beach town, a town that welcomed progress as a friend, resisted not at all, and in the short span of a person's lifetime, died under its feet with little more than a whimper. Seaside, whatever it is today, is not a pretty little town, either in physical appearance or character. The Oregon coast wears on its shores a string of such pretty little towns, Cannon Beach, Manzanita, Nehalem, all today facing the same forces and models of thinking which have transformed so many of Oregon's coastal gems into a string of tasteless clunkers. Like Godzilla in a greenhouse, the tourist industry is a powerful force plowing through the small town's natural environment, leaving in its wake a trail of highway architecture, parking lots, condominiums, mobile home courts, souvenir junk outlets, and legalized gambling. And the pretty little town loses more than just its physical beauty to the impersonal wasteland of the commercially controlled tourist trap. It loses its small town energy and character, which are the truest sources of its beauty and grace, and which loss no cosmetic compromise by developers can remedy or replace. And a personal note. Connie Rose Anderson lived in Cannon Beach when she wrote the article I just quoted from. She was visited by a woman who was celebrating adoption of a 9-year-old girl who had been an orphan. The woman took the girl to Indian Beach on the south side of Tillamook Head, which is notorious for its rocky shore and monstrous tides. The girl was washed off a rock into the ocean. I was an EMT on the emergency rescue squad of the Cannon Beach Volunteer Fire Department, headed by Cleve Rupert, who later became the fire chief. We were summoned to Indian Beach and spread out in pairs on the rocky, tide-lashed shore. I was partnered with Ed Myers, with whom I was trained as an EMT, and who soon after attended medical school on Portland's Pill Hill and became an MD, a psychiatrist, and a Sufi. A large Coast Guard helicopter showed up to help us, piloted by one of only a few women pilots in the Coast Guard at the time. She took the big bird down to the top of the wild water to use the downdraft of her main rotors to lay down the swells. We saw a flash of the girl only once, but the pilot kept at it, moving back and forth over the water while her copter tossed in the wind. I was worried that any second she and her crew would be victims of the wind and water. I thought we on the rocks might be also sucked into the ocean as we danced back and forth, dodging huge incoming swells. We could not hear the helicopter over the tremendous noise of the ocean pounding upon the rocks, nor could we hear each other unless we shouted directly into an ear. I was reminded of volunteer surf rescue teams of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, such as those who rescued the crew of the Peter Iredale that had crashed on a beach south of the Columbia River Bar 110 years ago in 1906. We were unable to save the girl. Wind, water, and time forced us to give up as darkness obscured our vision. All of us on shore were cold and soaked from spray, and I imagine the brave pilot and her crew felt wrung out by all the shaking they had endured inside the helicopter. The girl's body washed ashore a week or so later. Connie Rose, who was deeply sorrowed by the girl's tragic death, asked me to accompany her when she was requested to identify the dead girl. She left Cannon Beach a short time later. I'd like to read now, again, something I wrote, and which, in one guise or another, I have read on this program, The Virgins of Spring, and a quote by Maurice Chevalier, Thank Heaven for Little Girls. Spring. Time for the ritual festivals of fertility, the interminable spectacles of middle-aged men of various fraternal orders fawning over the season's vernal young princesses while obliterating any resemblance to the age-old carnality of these annual rites of fecundity. Humanity's biological clock does not keep the same tempo as its intellectual designs. We are still pagan savages underneath our surface dust of civilized society. Our ancient fertility rituals are layered in antiseptic disguises that reflect a rigidly puritanical and sexually repressed culture, despite flagrant pornography. Our libertine male ancestors, elders of various tribes or clans, demanded first crack at every spring's virgin girls, and later, within reach of our own era, noblesse oblige gave a local baron the rights to consummate a marriage with the virgin bride of a peasant. Old bulls in the natural world fight young stags for amatory dominance over a plurality of females. Old bulls in the contrived human world compete with hair implants, sporty automobiles, and Viagra. Older men have always wanted to mate with young girls, not from nostalgia for lost youth, but to consolidate aging and vitiated genes with strong, robust genes, maintaining a vigorous heredity by minimizing the disadvantages of worn-out RNA. Although the desire for young lambs is socially degenerate, it reflects age-old lusts and determination to survive through greater genetic diaspora. However, for the same reasons older men strive to preserve their reproductive vitality and biological imperative, few younger women are willing to risk impairing their own genetic possibilities with old dogs past their prime. After all, randy young men are strong and eminently virile and potent bulls yet, and offer the best opportunity for sturdy stock. As a woman wrote once, sperm is cheap, eggs are expensive. The sexual desire of older men and women for girls and boys is an insensate desire, a primeval siren's call to reinvigorate reproductivity. However, like individual body cells, each person's purposes and depravities are their own. Children throughout history have been initiated early to sex, more often as not by adults. Only recently has society prolonged sexual abstinence, just as it has also prolonged childhood itself. Laws and social restrictions are designed to prevent promiscuous older persons from debauching children, especially to keep predatory males off the bodies of young girls until they grow old enough to make their own decisions. Older men and women, in consequence, stifle their sexual desires for the young in fear of social disapproval and legal retribution, and sublimate them in various ways. But those who do not are very often explosive with their thwarted desires and become deviant and violent in pursuit of them. The manner in which child abuse is ostracized drives predators underground and into more violent acts. The strictures that attempt to protect children quite likely perpetuate grotesque molestation and sexual murders of children. Pornography, promiscuity, and pedophilia are results of sexual repression and are in turn demanded to be suppressed. A civilization out of control breeds violence and insecurity, which is taken out on children by neurotic, bitter adults. Movies, documentaries, groups of parents, and others throughout the country advocate for laws for greater protection of children, yet abuse flourishes underground. Society is ruled by taboos, and people are shamed into being ashamed of their thoughts. At root is puritanical repression, which creates malignant suppression and brutal psychopathic eruption. Instead of shaming the citizenry, tyrannizing and tantalizing them simultaneously, we should be presented reason. Why indeed do elderly males and females lust for the young? Is it truly an aberration of the abominable, or actually a primordial desire and long-time necessity to strengthen genetic potency? Another question might delve into our psychotic and pathetic dread of sexual intimacy. There is, as an article in Time magazine alluded to a few years ago, a, quote, preoccupation with child abuse. In an age when lurid lyrics, sniggering sitcoms, and trash-talking stars work hard to rob children of innocence, the sexually abusive parent, guardian, or family friend is not only a predator in his own right, but also a stand-in for all the gaudy malevolence of pop culture. The public reacts with wide eyes and a bit of drool at the corner of the mouth. The public gets to be puritanical and voyeuristic simultaneously. James R. Kincaid, author of Child Loving, The Erotic Child and Victorian Culture, wrote in a New York Times op-ed piece, "The story our culture feels it deserves would allow us to speak endlessly about child sexuality and the sexual attraction of children for others, while maintaining our distance from these lurid tales. The moving story of how parents affirm the unspeakableness of sexual interest in children by speaking of it frequently." And that was Kincaid. For thousands of years, it was acceptable for adults to have sexual relations with children, with a few exceptions, such as Native American cultures, which regarded child sexual abuse as a capital crime. Children have since antiquity been raised for sex, as slaves for purposes of prepubescent prostitution, or more insidiously, for personal sexuality, such as incest. Only recently has intensifying concern and a collective sense of shame about child sexual seduction initiated a campaign to prevent and punish it, and in particular to warn and protect children. The law attempts to protect children essentially because they don't have the intellectual maturity to differentiate between what feels good and what is good. These laws are specific. It is against the law for any adult to engage in any form of sexual activity with a child under any circumstances, even if the child initially tried to attract the adult or assented to sex with an adult. One woman expressed eloquently the public's inflamed anger at the surge of child molestation. "If anyone messed with my daughters," she said, "I would nail his penis to a stump in the middle of the woods, set the stump on fire, hand him a rusty axe, and walk away." Child molesters do not sexually abuse children because they are depraved, but because of opportunity. Prison does not change pederasts' attraction for children, and eventually they get out of jail. In a number of states, child molesters who have served their sentences are kept behind bars, which is unconstitutional, and which many believe addresses a flaw in the legal system through the back door. Convicted child abusers are also targeted with emblems that identify them as molesters once released from prison, in the manner early American colonial Puritans publicly marked sexual deviants. Yet the problem remains. What should be done with pedophiles who will commit such acts again and again? Given the choice of pardoning a child molester, the public would most likely set the serial murderer Barabbas free. Following a long period of neglect, public antipathy towards child abuse, whether sexual or violent or both, has swung to an extreme, making almost any adult contact with children suspect, which only severs connections between generations that are perhaps the most necessary links for human continuity other than reproduction. Hitler's policy of turning children against their parents was never as successful, alienating generations, as the potential suspicion between young and older is apt to be in regard to pederasty. We seem obsessed with denying our children exposure to things they most want to know and will eventually discover on their own. We disregard our own youthful impatience to learn and grow up, and instead inflict identical deceits we endured upon our children. We wish to shield them from unpleasant realities and attempt to forcibly repress their sexuality, yet we expect them to somehow cope. A recent book criticizes the fearful overprotection of children from sexual knowledge and experience, faulting the anti-sex puritanism of our culture, and defends adult-child sex as indispensable to sexual awakening. Reaction to the book has obviously been shrill, bordering on revulsion and hysteria. The reflexive response is to ban the book or burn it. But it was meant to be controversial. There is no debate and no democracy without controversy. As Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, the cornerstone of the First Amendment is the free and unfettered assertion of thoughts and beliefs, even expressions or opinions we loathe and believe to be fraught with death. And that was Holmes. The mass molestation of boys and a few girls by Catholic priests has intensified the controversy over adult child sex, but it has also raised the unholy specter of homophobia as a response, which distorts the real problem of adults exploiting their authority to coerce children into fornication that is equivalent to rape. A universal dilemma is that the intense and dynamic sexual magnetism of young males and females to draw them toward each other for propagation radiates so strongly that it pulls in many more than just a few old fools unable to resist the lure. That seductive charisma is a reason we personally and culturally not only worship youth and baldly exploit it once past its manic angst, but define the rest of our lives by the short period we are young. Human beings are middle-aged and old nearly twice as long as being young, given average life expectancy, 3.5 score years plus. Youth really has a single purpose, to grow, mate, and propagate. The rest of life is tending successful generations and attempting to prepare a better world for them than we currently live in, an essential goal and hope of every generation. Children have much more to worry about than more recent generations of their elders. Perhaps an instinctive premonition that the species is in grave danger of self-annihilation might be leading to much younger sexual contact, reminiscent of the greater part of our history when the average person seldom lived past 30 or 40. Or it might be a desperate measure to circumvent age, which fatally attacks at the very organs of procreation. The virtually uncontaminated bodies of children who are barely mature might be subliminally designated to carry and preserve the seed of the species. This might be a partial, if insufficient, explanation for the rise of child molestation by adults. So we sanitize our public sexual ceremonies in the same manner we act unconscious of the implications of dressing little girls to resemble women and dress older women as prepubescents. catalogs for children's apparel display girls seductively modeling sexy clothing, as well as nightwear, which are designed and marketed by adults. We are, however, a contradictory species. At the same instant we arouse the ancient lust for young girls and or boys, we act aggressively against child molestation. We ruthlessly strip the ancient fertility festivals of overt carnality while older men pantomime with much flair and flim-flam the covert seduction of ceremonial queens selected from among virgin princesses to rule imaginary courts of spring, Scandinavia, roses, or regatta. Only fools and hypocrites deny the attractions of the beautiful young. Young women and men are among the grandest creatures on earth. We all love youth, reproductively, restoratively, and retrospectively. The distinction between abusive touching of our young and caresses that reflect love and respect are necessary for all of us to know. Dreams and attractions are out of our control. Our responses to them are not. And that was The Virgins of Spring, which I wrote. And now I'd like to read a poem by Richard Shelton, Summer's Children. We do not know who chose us, but we are the chosen. We were chosen not to be you. We enter your cities like fog, with our bedrolls and our portable lives, our ragged coats always too big, the better for sleeping in. We follow summer, and we all look alike to you, with our uncombed hair. We look like winter. When we are young, we look older. When we are older, we begin to look young. You do not want to look at us, and since we are invisible to you, we can urinate anywhere. We are not lost. We know where we are. But our itinerary is chance and weather. We do not believe in destinations, and we are in no hurry. We have learned patience from statues in 1,000 parks and joy from dogs without collars. We do nothing you want. We can live on what you throw away. We envy only birds of passage, their ability to fly. Sometimes we ask for your spare change, but never your credit cards. Otherwise, we keep our distance, avoiding the gems of your misery. The wolf does not come to our doors. We have no doors. We have lost our names somewhere and are required to sign nothing. We do not pay taxes. We feed the birds. We do not vote. Why should we vote for you? We do not join the army. We are an army, and we will not fight in your wars. We have lost our return addresses, our forwarding addresses, our social security numbers, and are secure in our own society. We leave messages to one another on the undersides of bridges in a code you cannot decipher, but we plot to overthrow nothing. We escape. We are summer's children, born into your winter. We are not a problem. We are a solution to a problem. You are the problem. And that was Summer's Children by Richard Shelton. And I'd like to read another poem in tribute, The Goddess of Liberty by V.O. Blum, but first I wrote an introduction. June 4th was the 27th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. That was the day in 1989 in Beijing when the People's Liberation Army of China was ordered by the government to disperse mass demonstrations by the democracy movement, which was primarily made up of at least 100,000 or more students. Soldiers opened fire at Tiananmen Square in Beijing with automatic weapons and killed hundreds, perhaps thousands. Thousands more were wounded. Several thousand others were arrested, many of whom simply disappeared. The Communist Chinese government cracked down on the underground Christian church, tightened regulations on study abroad, and revived Maoism and its cult of adoration. Yet the movement toward democracy, though stifled, did not disappear. Student groups went underground or in exile. Chinese citizens refused to turn in activists to the police, and many of the movement's leaders escaped China to continue to work for liberation of their country. Associated Press photographer Jeff Widener captured what might be the iconic photo of the demonstration, of a man who stopped a line of Chinese tanks by standing in front of them. Jim Stoffer, a nationally acclaimed freelance photographer from Astoria, photographed the demonstrations in Beijing 2 weeks before the Tiananmen massacre. A year later, a portfolio of his photos appeared with portions of a diary he kept in the North Coast Times Eagle, May 1990. Michael Horowitz, aka V.O. Blum, wrote a poem that summer of 1989 in tribute to the dead Chinese students. His poem also commemorated the appearance of the Goddess of Liberty in Tiananmen Square, which was a homemade sculpture made of plaster or paper mache. In tribute, the Goddess of Liberty. There she was in the square, lifting her torch above the crowd, leading scholars against tyranny. Her frozen likeness guards New York, but she was last seen in action in the streets of Paris in the uprising of 1830, immortalized by Delacroix, Liberty guiding the people. Our romance was in Mexico in the late 1930s, where Rosa had gone to help Cardenas, but the news was bad. Guernica, Munich, and she began drinking at noon. I left the morning she confused me with Trotsky. Yet I never worried about her. When your politics are as good as hers, angels pay your rent. It was good to see you, Rosa, raising hell in China. Michael Horowitz is chancellor of what he claims to be the world's smallest university, Vavayu Academy for Critical and Applied Research in Nuku'alofa, the capital city of the Kingdom of Tonga in the South Pacific. He is the author most recently of Down Mind, a psycho-experimental novella published by Steam Press in New Zealand, and earlier published by Times Eagle Books of Astoria, Equator, The Story and the Letters, an erotic New Age novel, 1989, Sunbelt Stories, illustrated by Hank Pander, 1994, and Split Creek, War Novel of the Deep West, 2003. He also compiled and wrote the commentary for A Freak's Anthology, Golden Hits from Buddha to Kubrick, published by Kingsport Press in 1972. And I'd like to finish the program with a poem by Arthur Honeyman in honor of the Rose Festival this coming weekend in Portland, Festival of Roses. Cast with rose petals and paraded on slow gliding rolling wheels, visions of flowery icons and landscapes flow as if floating on gentle air, like breeze blown dandelion seed pods, to remind us of the gala burst of spring that seasonally brims over with beauty, giving warm promise of festive colors of red and pink and purple and white and yellow and diver more variations to celebrate rebirth in the cycle of life and the crowning beauty of youth and roses and roses and roses and roses. And another personal note. Tomorrow is 1 month past Arthur Honeyman's 76th birthday, and yesterday was 6 months less than 8 years past the day he died. After Michael Toccini died 15 years ago, I wished her clear, intelligent, and warm KMUN radio voice would be our introduction to other sentient ears among the oscillating spheres. I wish also that Arthur's brilliant, spasticating spirit will be with her. That would be, as he said, roses and roses and roses and roses. This has been Michael McCusker.